Living, the Y for a better us.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lori. Coming up, we're going to talk a lot about what's going on in Puerto Rico. And then later on, we'll talk about what happened last night in Las Vegas. First, one listener comment about last Friday's program. On last Friday's program, we were talking about veterans of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan who were exposed to burn pits and then came down with some major health problems. The conversation then went on to the Vietnam War last Friday. Here's what one listener had to say about last Friday's show.
Bill and Holiday here. I was just listening to your program. I just want to make a comment on your comment that we buy a lot of stuff from Vietnam, like those shirts you have. I think it's more accurate to say that we buy a lot of stuff from American manufacturers and middlemen who have things made in Vietnam very cheaply, taking advantage of very cheap labor and sweatshop labor, basically. So the Vietnamese aren't really benefiting from that. That's all. Thank you.
Well, there you have a comment that came in after last Friday's program. Coming up, we're going to hear Florida this week from this past Friday night. The big topic was the U.S. response to the devastation in Puerto Rico. And among the panelists on this show, former Democratic gubernatorial candidate Alex Sink. She's one of the panelists on this show. This is 88.5 FM WMNF. Coming up next, the post-hurricane crisis continued this week in Puerto Rico. The Tampa Bay Times reports on disorganization at emergency evacuation shelters in Florida. Democrats win a special election for state Senate, and public schools in Florida are becoming more segregated. Political Insights next on Florida This Week.
From the WEDU studios, this is Florida This Week. And now, moderator Rob Lori.
Welcome back. This week, our panelists are Alex Sink is the former Florida CFO and a Democrat. Katie Sanders is the deputy editor for PolitiFact. Susan McManus is a distinguished professor of government and international affairs at the University of South Florida. And Connie G. Abate is the founder of G. Abate Strategic Partners, and she's a Republican. Well, thank you for coming to the program. Great to have you here. Well, the recovery from Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico has been slow and painful. More than a week after it received a direct hit, the basics of living were scarce for many Puerto Ricans. Electricity, water, food, fuel, and phone service were all in short supply, especially everywhere outside of San Juan. Many roads were impassable. Some residents described the scene as apocalyptic. Some residents complained that the Trump administration has been slow and unprepared to deal with the emergency. Connie, let's start with that. Has the criticism of President Trump been fair this week, that his administration wasn't up to the job and that his HHS secretary, too, has painted too glowing a picture of what's going on there?
Well, actually, the preparedness for a hurricane in Puerto Rico started on September 5th. When he signed the first emergency declaration for Irma going through, that immediately released funding and turned the responsibility over to FEMA, part of HHS. Funding, ships, military were called in to help the recovery efforts for Irma. And that was also signed on the same day that Irma hit Puerto Rico. With Maria, it was the same thing. He signed the second emergency declaration on September 20th as the hurricane was traveling through Puerto Rico.
But Connie, it's one thing to sign a declaration. It's another thing to actually get the aid of the people. I mean, there are people who say they don't have water, they don't have food, medicine. Some seniors are living without any relatives being able to get to them. I mean, this is a pretty dire situation.
Well, actually, there are supplies on the island. There are 10,000 containers sitting at the port in San Juan. Now, remember the logistics. It's an island. There are no roads. The roads, as your clip said, they're impassable. The electric grid was out. Communication grid is out. The only three ports they have are medium size, so they don't even have a port the size of our port of Tampa. And yet 26 ships have been assigned to Puerto Rico. U.S. ships have been assigned to serve Puerto Rico. The supplies are there, but because only 20% of the truck drivers have shown up to take those supplies to where they need, there's a shortage of truck drivers.
Let me ask you, Alex. Alex, what do you think the president's response has been to the hurricane in Puerto Rico?
Well, it's been inadequate. If he's the first weekend after the storm, he's busy tweeting about the NFL and the NFL controversy when we have 3.5 million fellow American citizens who are suffering in an apocalyptic situation. And as a leader, I would have expected him to be front and center and recognizing that, granted, we've never seen anything like this in our country's history, really, and it just demands from the get-go a very strong military presence, because this is a logistical nightmare, and it's the military that knows how to go into these areas and set up communications and facilities for toilets and food and distribution. And here we are 9 days later, and we've just now had the generals are coming in, and hopefully it's not too late.
The president is going there in the coming week, and he's going to make an on-site visit to Puerto Rico. Do you think that'll help?
It should, because I think that he needs to see firsthand with his own eyeballs. There's when I was in Tallahassee and we had tornadoes and storms, there's nothing like seeing firsthand the scope. I can't even imagine the scope of the devastation there. So I think it will help when he sees. And just like George Bush going to New Orleans that first time, you've got to be on the ground and say, oh my gosh, this is really, really bad, and we're going to put all the resources that we have and call the military in to get this thing straightened out.
Go ahead.
Actually, post-Irma, 10,000 DOD employees were deployed to Puerto Rico to help with the post-Irma efforts, and some of them did stay there. The Marines were the first to arrive to do exactly what Alex said, to start fixing the communications towers, the air traffic control towers, the electrical grid, so they could start communicating with people, and so Puerto Rico could start communicating with the United States. As far as the visit by President Trump, remember, anytime he goes somewhere, that consumes a lot of resources. And by him not going until next week, it allows those resources to stay focused on the recovery efforts.
Would it be better if he stayed away, given that? Would it be better if he
stayed away? No, I think when it is safe and it's the right time, as has been the decision made, then yes, he definitely should go there.
With only 5% of the island having electricity, maybe he should wait.
If, again, he has military on the ground, he has FEMA on the ground, he has a specially appointed FEMA representative who has been there, again, since post-Irma. So they are his eyes and ears, and they are directing him about when is the appropriate time. Again, right now, all resources that are there are focused on getting Puerto Rico functional, opening those roads, the communications, the electricity, getting the supplies to people. So that's where the resources need to be spent.
I think it's going to take a little bit more time for us to sort out whether the president's response has been good enough or not. But I would say the criticism so far hasn't just been from Democrats. You have some people like Marco Rubio who have been there and not necessarily criticizing Donald Trump, but certainly saying they need more. They need more help. The military needs to be more aggressive in terms of taking over the logistics. So it's not all going exactly according to plan. But right now they're in a life or death situation where they're working quickly to get food and water into people's hands. I think once we're a little bit more removed from this chaotic period, we'll start to get some answers. Certainly this is going to be looked at for a long time because it's a major test for the
president.
Susan,
politically speaking, when a chief executive has an emergency and deals with it, I'm thinking of Jeb Bush. He had several hurricanes during his time, and I think he was looked at as an on-site leader. President Trump is in a really sticky position here because it goes to the question of his leadership, doesn't it? And aren't there political ramifications if it's not, in the end, handled well?
Of course there are, but as everyone has said here, it's a very complex situation. He absolutely must go. People, at a minimum, in a crisis, expect to see their chief executives, whether it's a mayor or a county commissioner or a governor or a president. That's expected, and the timing has to be right. And of course, what a lot of people get very upset about is immediately turning this into some kind of political game when people are suffering and dying. And I think that there can be a backlash on that end too. But without question, chief executives are judged on responsiveness to emergency situations more than any other factor. We have plenty of evidence of that.
Okay, so there's 3.5 million people in Puerto Rico. A lot of the island has lost everything. It's been destroyed. And some of those people are going to be temporary or permanent evacuees to the United States. They have full citizenship, so they can come here. So what does that do, especially to a state like Florida? You know, because a lot of Puerto Ricans have families here, and there's a lot of connections in Central Florida, Kissimmee, a big area, Tampa also a big area, Miami a big area for the Puerto Rican community. What happens to politics here in the state of Florida if some of those people evacuate and decide to move here permanently?
Well, without a doubt, I believe we'll see hundreds of thousands of Puerto Ricans relocating to Florida. And as we speak, our governor should be gathering people together to plan for what does that mean, when might they be coming, is there sufficient housing, is there a social network set up to support many of the people, and I would say most probably have family here already. But it's going to put incredible pressures, particularly in areas like the Orlando area, which has such a large population of Puerto Ricans. And we've already seen the politics in Orlando has changed significantly from historically Republican to now Democratic over the past 10 years because of the influx of Puerto Ricans. So, Rob, I think in a state like Florida, where the margin of victory has been within 1% in so many of our elections, it could have an impact upon who wins and who loses going forward.
And a lot of the families that move here are going to have kids in school. And so that puts a whole
Absolutely.
Burden on the school systems around the state of Florida.
And health care and
hospitals,
insurance issues and Medicaid issues. And I would encourage the governor, if I were speaking to him, to put together a task force now to begin thinking through all the implications of this mass influx of people that I believe will be coming here and staying permanently.
All right. Well, the Tampa Bay Times carried a story last week raising questions about whether Florida has enough shelter space for evacuees if we get another powerful storm like Hurricane Irma.
More than 5.6 million Floridians evacuated their homes as Irma approached. In a typical emergency, 5 to 10% of those evacuees would seek to ride out such a storm in an emergency shelter. What Times reporter and regular Florida This Week panelist Adam Smith discovered was that there was disorder and confusion. Some shelters did not have enough people to staff them. Parts of some shelters were deemed unsafe from hurricane force winds. Some evacuees with special medical needs or pets were turned away. Others were turned away because the shelters were full. Violence and mayhem broke out in some. The Times found that there was a shortage of generators, cots, food, and properly trained managers. More than a decade ago, then-Governor Jeb Bush had promised to instill a culture of preparedness by spending more than $560 million on emergency systems for future hurricanes, including spending money on additional shelter space and shelter generators. And the question is, has Governor Rick Scott's administration paid attention to this culture of preparedness advocated by Jeb Bush?
Well, Katie, let's start there. Adam Smith's story, I think, really was an eye-opener. And do you think that that culture of preparedness that was started by Jeb Bush was in place for this current series of hurricanes?
Well, it was hard to turn on the television in the days before Irma and after without seeing the governor urging people to either evacuate or to go to a shelter. The time is now. He was very visible in terms of stressing how important or how dangerous this storm was. But I think what Adam Smith's story revealed is that on the micro level, it was a lot of mistakes and a lot of miscommunication among people who are supposed to be running the shelters and people who were in, supposed to be staffing them, turning people away because they had pets. There were a lot of missteps, and this story really documented from South Florida on up all these missed places. You had fights breaking out, you had people, not enough pet shelters opening up, and people were actually not even going to the shelters because through word of mouth they heard they weren't taking pets. So I think that the governor next time is going to be hopefully much more in communication with establishing what people should do with the plans that are in place and maybe discussing that earlier on. It's not just the governor, it's people across many counties who need to do that.
So in some cases it was a question at the very local level, who's in charge here? And so in some places it's like the big picture.
Yeah, so I think in Miami-Dade, there was a miscommunication between the school superintendent and the American Red Cross. The American Red Cross said they were prepared to staff 8 shelters, and meanwhile, the need grew to more than 40. And so there weren't adequate staffing in those places. Both sides are griping, but they need to come to an understanding the next time a Category 5 storm starts to threaten the state.
And Connie, just based on what we learned from Irma, were we prepared, and has that culture of preparedness remained in place that Jeb Bush suggested more than a decade ago?
Well, the original culture of preparedness was not just Jeb Bush. It was a much larger study. And it also placed responsibility upon the residents of Florida. There was a very detailed list of everything that they needed to do to have their kits ready, their cots ready, their sleeping bags, their water, their medicines, to have everything ready. Now, we have to understand that the school system and the county emergency managers and the Red Cross start developing their plans in June of every year for that season's hurricane. And as Katie had said, in Miami-Dade, the school system determined that 40-some schools could be used as shelters, but that they would prepare for 8. So the Red Cross goes back and says, okay, we need the staff for 8 shelters. That was a capacity of 180,000 people. However, 600,000 people needed shelter.
The need was much greater.
The need was much greater, yeah. And that had not been discussed since after the June plan was already in place.
So would you say that the local officials then weren't really adequately prepared in a place like Miami-Dade?
That would be my opinion. Yeah. I would suggest that they go back and review the plans, maybe have a plan in place for June or do it in June, but really prepare for a Category 5.
Mm-hmm. Alex, we as a society, I don't think that we really think that much about a hurricane, as Connie and Katie just said, until the last minute. You know, and I don't sense that from the governor on down, I don't get a sense that we're getting information that says, okay, at this point in hurricane season, you should be here. And at this point in hurricane season, you should have all this stuff prepared and, you know, think about your shelters and all that.
Well, I think it all goes back to when was the most recent hurricane? So, for example, remember in 2004 and 2005, we had eight hurricanes, 4 back-to-back hurricanes in 2 years. I went into office in early 2007, and hurricane preparedness was very much on people's minds because we had all that experience. And then, Rob, we went, would you believe, 11 years mm-hmm. in the state of Florida yeah. with no hurricanes. So right. We forget about it. We forget about how to prepare, and probably all the tabletop exercises that were done, same thing happens. We've got a whole new crowd of people who had never, from the governor on down, who had never been through a hurricane or a major hurricane. And here's the other thing, too. Remember all the other hurricanes, they either went east-west or they kind of went kind of across the state. We've never had a hurricane situation like this one, which literally impacted the entire peninsula. And people were going back and forth like ping pong balls. Oh, I'm evacuating to Tampa. Oh, no, it's coming to Tampa. I'm going to evacuate back to the East Coast. And you have a governor there saying all Floridians should be prepared to evacuate. Now, that was irresponsible. We can't put 20 million Floridians on the road. So we've got to go back and learn from this experience and realize that some people have to learn how to shelter in place. And we also do have to go back and do an after action report and figure out what didn't work, what did work, and get ourselves prepared.
And for the next time. All right.
People forget we've had a lot more millions of people that live mm-hmm. here now than did even 10 years ago. Mm,
that's a big part of it, too. Yeah.
Well, Florida's Democrats picked up a rare win this week in a special election for a state Senate seat in Dade County.
Annette Tadeo beat State Representative Jose Felix Diaz in the race to claim Senate District 40. That's a seat once held by Frank Artiles, who resigned earlier this year after making racist comments. The margin of Tadeo's win was 51-47, with a third candidate picking up 2%. Tadeo had previously lost two races, one last year for U.S. Congress and as Charlie Crist's running mate in the 2014 gubernatorial election. Democrats painted Diaz as a Tallahassee insider and a Trump loyalist, while Republicans attacked Tadeo as a Fidel Castro apologist.
Susan, the Democrats never win. What did they do right here?
Well, the bottom line is Hillary Clinton heavily won that district by almost 20 points. So I don't think it was shocking whatsoever. But what it does that's even more important, because I'm always looking ahead to the next election, 2018, it really is a shot in the arm of enthusiasm for the Florida Democratic Party. It was a win that really energized them, and we'll see how much they're energized because they're getting ready to have a statewide conference in Orlando in a couple weeks. And it's also a wake-up call for the Republicans. There's an old saying that you can't get complacent. If you rely upon how you won last time, you might lose this time in a state like ours, where the last four elections have been determined by just a 1% margin, two governor's races, and two presidential.
Now, I hesitate to disagree with you, but you're right about Hillary Clinton winning that district. But also, this is rare because in off-year elections, not a presidential election, Democrats usually stay at home, don't they?
Usually, but this is not usual, nor was last year's election usual. And so you have an energy level and a get-even kind of and get-back kind of enthusiasm among Democrats right now that you haven't seen in a long time. And if you look at their successes in all of the special elections that have been held across the country, the same thing, the turnout has been exceptionally high for Democrats. And part of the mobilization is what they didn't do in the presidential, which is good old-fashioned local grassroots politics. I don't know how many doors were knocked on in South Florida. And by the way, I think the strategy of using Castro as a foil is not having the traction with the Cuban community it used to, because the Cuban community, the younger generation, is not as swayed by the anti-Castro politics as the elder Cubans, who are shrinking as a proportion of the Cuban population through generational replacement.
All right. Alex, are the Democrats fired up?
50,000 doors knocked down in the last 4 days of the campaign. And in that race, the Republicans outspent the Democrats. I heard today $6 million was spent by the Republicans and $3 million by the Democrats. $9 million spent just for a state Senate special election. The money is phenomenal, and usually money always wins, but I agree with Susan, and particularly the NPAs. It'll be interesting for you to go back and analyze. The independent voters broke very, very heavily for Annette today. So it'll be interesting to see in the future elections how the NPAs break.
And NPAs are under 40. They're large because a lot of the younger people today are not registering with the two major parties. They are the real genesis behind the rise in the no party affiliation registrants.
Connie, what's your takeaway from Senate District 40?
I think it has a lot more to do with her credentials and being in the public eye for over 30 years, primarily in that district and in the Miami-Dade area. She presents well. She's a small business owner, so she's credible. She has no black marks in her political history. And I would like to give her full credit for earning her election.
Okay. Well, Florida's public schools are becoming more segregated, according to a study out this week from the Leroy Collins Institute.
Researchers have a name for it. It's called intense segregation. It's defined as having a non-white population of 90% or above. And here in the Sunshine State, about one-third of all black and Hispanic kids attend such schools. Segregation is on the upswing. The number of segregated schools doubled from 1995 to 2015. And now one-fifth of all public schools in Florida are intensely segregated. The study also showed that the number of students defined as low income has been rising over the past 20 years, increasing from 36% to nearly 59%.
So, Alex, why should people care about this? Should we care about this?
Absolutely. And it's just a very disturbing statistic to me because, you know, in this environment that we're living now, Rob, with all the race talk of racism and racial profiling and trying to drive wedges between people, the only way for people to get together is to sit around a table together and see and understand people who are different from you, who look differently from you, who grew up differently from you. We talk about the military as being kind of a great equalizer, because that's the place during World War II that people of different races came together and they served and fought together. Well, the same is true of our school systems. I never wanted my kids to go to class with a bunch of other white kids. I wanted them, and I sent them to a public high school here in Hillsborough County that had Hispanics, blacks, white kids, and they learned how to appreciate and value other people. So it is important.
All right. Well, before we go, what other news story should we be paying attention to? Katie, let's start with you, your other big story.
I'm so interested in this story about the State Department withdrawing Cuban diplomats from Havana after this sonic attack, and it's left, I think, 20 people with traumatic brain injury and hearing loss. The FBI doesn't know what happened. They don't know who's responsible. They say it could be another country even. There's a lot more to uncover there, and it's pretty freaky.
A real big mystery. All right, Connie, your other big story?
I think we need some serious history about our Civil War and our, especially the slavery, and it's prompted by the NFL, the Jacksonville Jaguars and the Ravens going to London and taking a knee, but then they stand for the British National Anthem, and it was England who, starting in the 1500s, went to Africa, bought 3 million slaves from Africa, slave trade, brought them here to the States, and since we didn't gain our independence until 1776, that's 250 years of slavery in this country under British rule. So I found that kind of sad, comically sad.
All right. Susan, your other big story.
The USF Nielsen Sunshine State Survey was released this week, and we studied the concerns of Floridians for elders. A huge percentage of our citizens say that they're really worried about being able to pay for nursing home care for themselves and their families, but they're also very, very concerned that the state is not doing enough to handle people who abuse, caregivers who abuse the elderly. And surprisingly, 51% are in favor of allowing the option of someone to terminally end their life, a physician to terminally end the life of a terminally ill patient. So things and attitudes about Floridians, about the elders, were very heightened even before the nursing home debacle in South Florida.
All right. Now, what's your other big story?
Well, very quickly, it has to do with emergency preparedness. I read that the head of emergency preparedness resigned to go into the private sector, and Governor Scott just appointed a 29-year-old with no experience who's a political operative to head up emergency management services. And I served with Craig Fugate, who was phenomenal. And it just worries me that our governor appoints people into these really critically important positions who are absolutely not qualified. It's going to spell trouble in the future.
All right, we're going to have to pay attention to that story. Well, thank you all for a great show, and thank you for watching Florida This Week.
That was Florida This Week from this past Friday night on WEDU-TV. And my guests were Alex Sink, the Democrat. She was on that panel. Also, Connie G. Abate was the Republican on the panel. Dr. Susan McManus from USF was there, and so was Katie Sanders from PolitiFact. She was on that program. We've got several emails from people about it. This person, Bob, writing in regarding President Trump's planned visit to Puerto Rico tomorrow. Bob writes, Trump should stay away until there's an open golf course. In other words, he should stay away, writes Bob, who's in Palmetto. Now, Jeff writes this, libtards are really pathetic. Did that bubblehead on your show just say not all the criticism is from Democrats? And then the only example she gave had to be qualified with it's not criticism. Typically ignorant libtard. Why are you letting that idiot babble? That's Jeff's email, Jeff, pretty angry at that program. And Peter writes this, just thought of this. The difference between hurricanes and tornadoes is with tornadoes, you have maybe 6 to 10 minute warning. With hurricanes, you have 6 to 10 days warnings. How can we use the experience of the tornado states to our advantage, writes Pete, who's in Indian Shores. We're going to open up the phone lines in just a moment. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. And our email address is dj@wmnf.org. Here's the latest on the massacre last night in Las Vegas. A gunman perched on the 32nd floor of a Las Vegas hotel casino unleashed a hail of bullets on an outdoor country music festival below, killing at least 50 people as tens of thousands of concertgoers screamed and ran for their lives, officials say. It was the deadliest mass shooting in modern U.S. history. More than 400 others were hurt and taken to the hospital. SWAT teams using explosives stormed the gunman's hotel room in the sleek, gold-colored glass skyscraper and found that he had killed himself, authorities said. He had as many as 10 guns with him, including rifles. There was no word on a motive for the Sunday night attack, but a law enforcement official speaking on condition of anonymity to discuss the still unfolding investigation said that there was no immediate indication it was connected to international terrorism. In the Middle East, the Islamic State group claimed responsibility for the attack and said the gunman was a soldier who had converted to Islam months ago, but it provided no evidence. Country music star Jason Aldean was performing Sunday night at the end of the three-day Route 91 Harvest Festival in front of a crowd of more than 22,000 when the gunman opened fire from inside the 44-floor Mandalay Bay Hotel and Casino across the street. That was the start of last night's massacre in Las Vegas. The suspect is 64-year-old Stephen Paddock, the man suspected of killing more than 50 people and injuring 400 when he opened fire on concertgoers last night. His dead body was discovered by police in a room on the 32nd floor of the Mandalay Bay Resort following the deadliest mass shooting in U.S. history. Paddock lived just 90 miles outside Las Vegas in the city of Mesquite, where he bought a home in a retirement community back in 2015. He lived at the $400,000 property with 62-year-old Mary Lou Danley, the same woman police sought out for questioning about the terror attack. Paddock had hunting and fishing licenses, and he had a pilot's license, and may have worked at Lockheed Martin as an auditor, according to public records. He had no criminal record in the state of Nevada, and officials said at a press conference this morning that they're still looking into his possible motive. Paddock had committed suicide by the time police breached the door to the room from which the gunman had fired at the Mandalay Bay Resort just after 10 p.m. last night. At least 10 rifles were found in his hotel room. The attack played out as Jason Aldean performed on stage to closing out the third and final night of the Route 91 Harvest Festival. One woman who was at the Route 91 music event claimed an unidentified woman had told other concert goers that they were all going to die after pushing her way to the front of the venue.
It makes me feel uncomfortable, especially coming here for my 21st birthday and not knowing if I'm safe, not even knowing if I'm safe going home tomorrow on an airplane. So,
And how did you get out of the venue after this all happened?
We actually weren't there whenever the shooting had occurred. We had already left about maybe 10, 15 minutes before that. But we just barely made it back into our room whenever it started.
And, I mean, were you thinking, oh, my gosh, this woman told us that before we left?
Yeah, I thought it had a positive correlation to it. Like, obviously, she was telling us that in either to tell us to warn us or to tell us that we were all going to die, and she was part of it. So,
okay, so they want the description of this woman. Describe to me what this woman looked like.
Her and her boyfriend were both Hispanic. They were probably about shorter five-footers, probably about 5'5", 5'6". They just look like everyday people.
Can you tell us anything more about them, what they look like? Why were they escorted out? Were they escorted out because you were feeling uncomfortable about what they said?
Yes, because she had been messing with the lady in front of her and telling her that she was going to die, that we're all going to die. So they escorted her out to make her stop messing around with all the other people in front of them, but none of us knew that it was going to be serious.
Now, that was a 21-year-old woman who was at the concert who told that story. We don't know whether or not the two people she identified as being essentially kicked out of the concert were later involved in the shooting. But that was an interesting interview that happened this morning with a local Las Vegas television station. Sean writes, the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police says that 58 people have died now in the Las Vegas shooting. 515 have been injured. What we know more about the shooter, the brother of the Las Vegas shooter, said that he was a normal guy who must have snapped before carrying out the worst mass shooting in American history. Eric Paddock did interviews with the Orlando Sentinel and the Daily Mail, and Eric Paddock said his brother Stephen had absolutely no indication he could do something like this, and that Stephen had no political or religious affiliation. His brother said he was just a guy. Something happened, he snapped or something. Speaking from his home in Orlando, Eric, the brother, said, "We know absolutely nothing. This is just, we are dumbfounded." He said that his mother was in shock and struggling to cope with the news. He said, "Our family's okay. We're sitting here in our house hoping that everyone doesn't attack us." He said, "My mother's 90 years old, lives down the street from me. We're just completely dumbfounded." He's my brother, said Eric. "We don't have a very close relationship, but we talk occasionally. There's no rhyme or reason here. It makes no sense." So we're going to open up the lines and talk about this. Our phone number is 813-239-9663. Our email address is dj@wmnf.org. One news report says that the suspect, Stephen Paddock, checked into the hotel on Thursday, on September 28th, I guess my questions are, it's often said, especially by NRA leaders, that the only way to stop a bad guy with a gun is to have a good guy with a gun. I assume that some of the people in that crowd might have been gun owners, but would more guns have changed things or have helped last night? And should hotel staff check rooms for guns? Because, you know, if you have 10 rifles in your room, conceivably the hotel staff that go in to clean the room might have seen those guns. So we can talk about that and get your response to this horrific tragedy in Las Vegas. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. And you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. Let's go to Bob, who's in Tampa. Bob, you're on. What would you like to say?
Yeah, just two quick comments. One of them is I'd wish people would stop the ridiculous name calling. That the person who emailed before used the word libtard. I mean, how can you have an intelligent conversation with someone if you're resorting to like middle school age name calling? It's just silly and embarrassing. And then I guess the second quick comment was you mentioned about hotel staff checking rooms. You could easily put a do not disturb on your door and never have anybody clean your room.
Yeah, well, that's certainly true. Yeah, and we don't know because the investigation is just beginning. All right, okay. Bob, thanks a lot. I agree with you. I think name-calling actually loses the debate. Anytime you name-call and you don't have a reasonable argument or facts and figures, it doesn't help.
Okay, thank you.
All right, Bob, thanks. 813-239-9663. Adam writes this: "I would like to know why Trump didn't declare the Vegas shooting a terrorist attack. He has jumped to tweet about every other attack, and now when we have a shooting by a white man who isn't Muslim, he prefers to act as it's evil and not terrorism," writes Adam. And again, our phone number, 813-239-9663. And you can comment about this horrific event in Las Vegas. And let's take some more phone calls. Jan Simpson is our phone producer today. Let's go to Tony in Sarasota. Hi, Tony. You're on WMNF. What would you like to say?
Hi. I don't want to sound too much like a conspiracy theorist, but they found him dead in the room, right?
They did.
So there's the possibility that this guy is set up and that they picked somebody of an age demographic that the shooter actually wanted and got out of there without ever being ID'd, tagged, or noticed. That's the only thing. If everything doesn't make sense, then why did he do it?
Well, I at this stage, nothing makes sense, but as the investigation goes on, I think things will become clearer. I think it's probably not helpful to question just based on your surmise. If it's just a guess that you have and you've got no evidence of anything, that's probably not helpful. After evidence comes out and you want to, raise questions, then maybe. But we don't know any of the details yet. So I'm not sure it really helps to raise questions like yours at the beginning. It's certainly always, I think it's always smart to be skeptical, but I think it's way too soon to claim any sort of conspiracy or anything remotely like what you suggest, Tony.
All right,
Tony, thanks a lot. Thanks for calling in. 813-239-9663. Somebody from the 813 area code anonymous says, is this really the time to talk about gun control? And this person answers the question, yes, it is. That's anonymous from the 813 area code. Pete writes this. I just thought of this one, too. At this point, the gun control issue maybe should be put on hold. How about having SWAT sharpshooters at major events in case this crap happens again, writes Pete. And, my question at the beginning was, would having people with guns open carry in that plaza in Las Vegas and at the adjacent Aldine concert, would that have helped at all? 813-239-9663, email address dj@wmnf.org. And let's go to Mike in St. Pete. Hi, Mike, you're on WMNF. What would you like to say?
Hi, I was just wanted to bring up the point of mental health. I mean, we talk about guns and whether it's right or wrong all the time. And I don't get the gun argument, tell you the truth. I don't see why people need guns. What we don't address in this country too much is mental health and how close people are to snapping. And we're getting more and more of these situations where people are just snapping. Mental health is a big issue, but we have a big taboo on it also.
Well, I agree with that. So what do you think should be done about mental health?
I think people need to look at it a different way. I mean, we look at our physical health, we go to the doctor. We get sick, we go to the doctor. But mental health, we hold it back and we hide in our room and we get drunk or we use drugs or we do whatever. We don't address the issues because of the stigma that we have on it. You can't go to work and say, well, I'm depressed, or I broke down last night. You can't do that. You get fired. So I don't know. I think it's just a mentality we have to change as far as how we look at people who have an issue with mental health.
So take away the stigma for asking for help if you're suffering from depression. And then is there other... I agree with that. I think that's exactly right. What else do you think we should do?
Well, I mean, that's just where you start. It's an attitude that we have toward it, that it's a bad thing. If this person is a bad person because, they're depressed or they have a problem, it needs to be addressed. We just need to have better services for mental health. I'm not saying it's going to take away an issue like last night. I mean, there's more involved there. But mental health is definitely on the front, and I think as economic issues weigh on people and life gets difficult, they snap.
All right, Dan, I think that's exactly right. Dan, thanks a lot.
And
so Dan talked both about access to services and taking away the stigma. I think both are right on target. Let's go to Dan in Tampa. Hey, Dan, you're on WMNF. What would you like to say?
I'd like to make a couple of points, Rob. Number one, the conspiracy thing, they can shoot that in the tail right now. Las Vegas is the most videotaped city in the world. They have cameras in everything there. It's a gambling mecca, and they're watching constantly. So they'll be able to track that guy once now they know who he is, I guarantee you they're looking at film to see every bit of his movement when he came in the building, if he came in, when he pulled in with his car, the whole nine yards. They could probably take it out to the street and follow him coming into the city. That's how many cameras are in that city. Okay. And the last caller is absolutely right. This started back in the 80s when Ronald Reagan and the Democrats that were in charge of the House and that and made deals and did away with a lot of mental health help to the states and such. And all they did basically was put a lot of these people out onto the street. And they wound up going into our prison system and killing people and getting put to death themselves. And it is a big stigma to have, you know, it's such a macho man thing, you know, in America, I guess, to say, oh, I've got issues, man. I just can't, you know, I got these thoughts or I got this. And, you know, people are going, oh, you're crazy. That's all that's wrong with you. You're crazy. Because I don't believe in assault weapons at all. But sometimes I sit to myself and I think, well, Canada is a country just to the north of us. They have a lot of guns there, Rob, that they hunt with. They don't have these issues. Now, I ask myself, is it because they're not under the same stress we are over our health care, over taking care of ourselves, or what? Because they do.
Yeah, yeah. Michael Moore pointed that out in his film about the NRA. All right, Dan, thanks a lot.
And one other thing, so when people talk about the gun issue, Rob, so I know a lot of folks out there don't realize this, but because of the NRA, the alcohol, tobacco, and firearms people are still running an antiquated system. They literally have to go to a file cabinet and look up and see if this number match up to the store over here. They've been unfunded, and because of the NRA's lobbying, Congress won't give them the money so they can check if people are mentally ill, so they can go online and punch it up in 2 seconds. They got to run over a building and look through a filing cabinet, maybe go to another one and another. By the time that person might have killed 20 people.
Yeah, all right. Well, we'll find out.
The NRA won't let them fund it.
Yeah, all right, Dan, thanks a lot. Thanks.
All right.
We'll find out about his motives, too. The shooter's motives as the days and weeks go on. Edward writes this, we can bet that the NRA, irresponsible capitalists that they are, will use this as a reason to say we should all run out and purchase more guns. NRA insanity is rampant in the USA, writes Ed from Largo. Terry writes this, security, screening, one guide, 10 bags, rifles, metal detectors, that's Terry's email. And James writes this, if you need an auto or a semi-auto gun and high-capacity clip for hunting, you need another hobby. As government takeover, you do know that they have drones and tanks, writes James. So James says that if there was a government invasion of civilian space, you would be a loser because the government has so many more weapons. 813-239-9663 is our phone number. And let's go to James in Tarpon Springs. Hi, James. You're on WMNF. What would you like to say?
Hey, on that note that he was saying about the mental illness testing, I think that's very valid for a lot of different reasons. And I think that should be done for a lot of different areas, especially like jobs like being a police officer where you're in charge of keeping people safe, you know, different things like that. I think they should have a standardized mental illness test. Also, what you were saying about would more guns help over in Las Vegas, I really think so. I think maybe even people should open up a whole new area of opportunity for people to go there with security jobs. You know what I mean? They can hold guns and everything like that. So, I mean, if they had a little bit of hired help, a few security guards, you never know.
So, James, how would
turned out better?
How would having more guns in Las Vegas have helped last night?
No, I'm saying like in that location. I'm saying if they had more.
My question is, how would having more guns in that location have helped last night?
Well, to be able to take him out,
if he's on the 32nd floor and you've got a handgun and you don't know which room you're shooting at and you shoot back at the hotel,
yeah.
Do you think innocent people might have been harmed?
So I guess, yeah, on that point, you know, only somebody who is capable of, you know, sharp shooting.
So, all right, James, yeah. Thanks a lot. Thanks for your phone call. Great to hear from you. 813-239-9663. What do you think? Let's go to Mike in Tampa. Hey, Mike, you're on WMNF. What would you like to say?
Morning, Rob. The issue of mental illness has gotten dragged out now. It's a ploy of the NRA and their minion in government. They drag that issue out. They say, well, this guy obviously had a mental illness, and then they walk away from it. So what do? They further stigmatize the numbers of mentally ill people who don't do anything like this, which there is a more positive correlation between people who have engaged in domestic abuse and these kind of incidents and than there is with somebody who's had a diagnosis of, say, schizophrenia or something. It just is such a canard. It is such a horrible, and I was going to say a bad word, it's such a rotten way to drag this into the NRA's narrative on this. And furthermore, as we all know, the guys who bring this up are not the guys who will ever vote one red cent into doing anything effective for people who suffer from mental illness.
Okay, so if it's wrong to emphasize mental illness, what should we emphasize?
Well, listen, gun death.
Mike, I hope you didn't get cut off.
Who's in charge of the public health stuff in the United States that does the best research? The Center for Disease Control. Who is not allowed by statute to study gun death? The CDC. You know that.
Yeah, well, we've talked about that many times here on MNF.
Right. So I don't know what we can do. I know one thing, even guys like Steve Scalise, who have now, he's been shot. He had his bowels ripped up and his hip blown off and all that stuff. He probably still votes with the NRA. It's a sickness. It really is. And here's the risk factor for gun death. Now, this is all gun death, especially suicide. You know what the risk factor is? Having a gun is the risk factor. That's the number one risk factor. As to this guy, how is this preventable? It's not preventable. It's, you know, somebody said earlier today on the news, you know, well, I guess we have to, now we have all these zones where we're not safe. Listen, every place, you're a soft target every day you wake up and walk out, you know?
Mike, thanks a lot. Thanks.
Sorry, I was yelling, Rob.
I don't know. You were fine. I have so many phone calls. I want to try to get a few more on and so many emails. Here's another anonymous email. I agree with the person talking about mental health needs, and I hope that Donald Trump sets his example and is the first one in line to get a mental health test. All right. Jan Simpson is our phone producer today. We're going to go back to the phones, and we're going to go to Carol in Tampa. Hi, Carol. You're on MNF. What would you like to say?
Hey, my point is having more guns. I don't see how that would help. Amid the panic and chaos, I think you'll be looking at more fatality.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out how having more good guys with guns would help that situation last night in Las Vegas.
Definitely not.
Yeah,
not at all.
All right, Carol, thanks a lot. Great to hear from you. And let's go to Fran in Largo. Hi, Fran, you're on MNF. What would you like to say?
Yes, if you have time, could you go over how Australia solved their gun problem? I know they had some mass shooting and they had enough of it. Okay,
well,
I'll get off.
Yeah, you know, what I did last year was I played John Oliver's segment about guns and mass shootings, and that segment is about he did like three or four parts for, I think he did it for the Daily Show actually. And I only have 30 seconds left. So what I'll do is somehow I'll try to get that John Oliver segment where he sent his reporters to Australia, and looked at what happened, what was their response to a mass shooting using a rifle maybe 10 or 15 years ago. And since then, since the regulations have been in place, how many mass shootings have they had? I wish I could explain it to you in 30 seconds, but I just can't. Stay tuned because Sean Canaan is going to discuss this very issue for the next hour. So stick around here on 88.5 FM. I'm Rob Lori. If you want to comment about today's show, please call us up at 813-238-8001. Record your comment on extension 115. I'll play your comments back tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. And stay tuned for the latest news, including the latest news about Las Vegas. This is WMNF Tampa, St. Petersburg. Here's the news.